Morning, the SADE 12 Budget Division will come to order. Today's Tuesday, April 7, 2015. It's 8:30 a.m. We're in room 112 at the State Capitol. We have several bills before us. First is Senate File 652. Senator Johnson, we also ask that your testifiers please join you at the table. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm pleased to be back here today asking for your support and for Senate File 652, which is the vision therapy pilot project program. This bill has been around since 2010, I believe.
2010, yeah.
2010, Ms. Thurman here, who is one of my testifiers, has been working on this issue with started with Senator Nienau, and then with Senator Nienau's help, then I introduced it on in the last session and then again in this session. We're looking for help with dealing with convergence insufficiency. And, you know, that's kind of not a common word, and I'll just give you a very brief definition just to set the tone for this. CI, which is what we call convergence insufficiency, is often associated with symptoms such as frequent loss of place while reading, loss of concentration, having to reread, reading slowly, poor comprehension, sleepiness, blurred vision, double vision, headaches, and eye strain, and possibly other things. But what we're looking for is a pilot program to determine if, with the treatment of students who have convergence insufficiency or other eye vision problems would help to reduce special education costs for our schools. I think it's a good one. We've had a lot of testimony on this bill over the last 5 years, and so I would like to introduce my testifiers, Dana Thurman, who is a special ed teacher at Centennial High School, and a student at Centennial, Dimitri Benson. No T in there.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Welcome to the testifiers. Please proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for your time again today. I don't want to reiterate exactly everything I've said in the past. I'm a special education teacher. I've been teaching at Centennial for 9 years. I'm actually in the field for over 30, and I've been in the public school for 25 years. And I have seen this conditions that Senator Johnson mentioned, that the covering of eyes, the fatigue, students not wanting to read, skipping lines. I've seen that since day one. There is, as we know, vision is an important skill to have in reading. 70 to 90% of what students learn in school is presented visually. One in four students who have vision issues. And then up to 60% of the special education students in my classroom, studies indicate, have learning-related vision issues. Now, I could not, for many reasons, I could not bring my students to fill this room to show you that, yes, I suspect, I mean, these are the 47 students I have in my classroom this semester. 25 of them, I suspect, have similar symptoms that Dimitri will describe that I see in class. So that's a roughly 52% of my students demonstrate issues that I suspect are related to vision and things that I cannot fix with the skills that I have and the training I've had in special ed. There's lots of we can reiterate that and we can go over it, but there's lots of studies that say that this convergence insufficiency treatment does work. My son, who needed it 9 years ago, is now applying for. He's a senior next year. He's going to be applying for. He wants to take college classes at a college, in a local college, and he needed to apply for it. He needed to write a letter, and he said one of the topics he had to write about was write about something that has changed your life. he wrote, he never disclosed this to me before until he wrote it in that letter, how much it had changed his life and how much he did remember having that vision therapy in second grade, now being an 11th grader, has changed his life. So he used that experience to write about. This vision therapy pilot program bill would bring innovation to our schools. I hear the legislature wants to have innovation and have new ideas brought to the schools, and this would do it. It would give parents choices, and it would also use our monies, our funding that we use in education, in a more wisely way. We use $20,000, I was quoted by Representative Barrett a few years ago, $20,000 a year to educate a special ed student. If we spent, and it takes about $4,000 to $5,000 to do 1 year of vision therapy on a student, and that's all they would need. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
Hi, I'm Demetri Bankson, Chairman, Senate. Thank you for having me have this opportunity to explain my side. I started when I was like in second grade. I was trying to get into, my mom was trying to get me into special education, and they wouldn't do it. And they kept pushing. Eventually, in fourth grade, they let me go into special education. Then I ended up getting. I had problems on reading, and I kept reading, and I was always seeing double. I always thought seeing double was normal and whatnot, and kept reading, and eventually I'd end up taking tests where teachers would end up, like, would read the test to me, and I'd answer questions off it, and it was just very difficult for me to read. And now I actually just started vision therapy 2 weeks ago, and it's made such a big difference in 2 weeks already, how I'm already being able to, like, read more at a better kind of without skipping lines or struggling reading. It's already getting better. And when I went in, they said, I'm like, well, I see double. And I always thought it was normal, and they're like, that's not normal. And so it's really gotten better for me.
Thank you for sharing your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to address a little bit the there's been a number of statements that have said that this is not a scientific method of treating vision, but in fact there have been clinical trials. And mm-hmm. I have asked Dana, because she's Dana, with our staff person Dana, I get confused. Mm-hmm. Dana is Dana Turman's name. But she will talk about a little bit about the clinical studies that have been put forward.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senate committee members, thank you. The treatments for convergence insufficiency have been going on since 1940. There's been some research that was compiled that the studies between 1940 and 1987, they summarized these studies and said that it's been going on for many, many years. The recent study that was done by Dr. Mitchell Scheinman out of Philadelphia, I've heard this called like the Cadillac of all research treatments. He did a treatment. The students were assessed and needed, and were all assessed with convergence insufficiency. There were three different treatments that were offered to these students. It was blind. Nobody knew. Even the administrators did not know. So it was office-based vision therapy. There was also the pencil push-ups was another treatment was used. And then there was an office-based placebo vision therapy that was also used. So over those 12 weeks, these students had an hour 5 days a week, and they also had work at home to do for 15 minutes a night. And this demonstrated that the office-based vision therapy did improve the iConvergence so that students could learn. So,
thank you.
With that, members, I'd ask for your support. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. And ask for your support. And I think this would be a great way to try to reduce our special ed costs in the school, also to close the achievement gap and prepare our workforce of the future, which is, I know, part of what we've all want to do.
Thank you. We'll take questions shortly. We do have a letter from the Academy of Ophthalmology expressing concerns. I'll ask if anyone in the audience would like to testify. Would anyone in the audience like to testify? Further, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Convergence insufficiency, is that a specific diagnosis or does it contain a range of abnormalities?
I couldn't answer that question for sure, but it definitely is a described symptom. I mean, CI is a described, what do we call it, disorder. And as I read to you from this, the National Eye Institute background and summary of their clinical study, that's how they describe it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee members? Sir Johnson, we're one shy of a quorum, but we will play it over once we are at that point. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, I'm looking at the letter from the Minnesota ophthalmologist that is concerned that you're prescribing a specific therapy, a specific outcome for your pilot program, and I'm wondering if you can talk to that and why you believe over the medical professionals that this is the right course.
Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, I believe, this is a pilot program, so we will be looking at, definitely we'll be looking at the office-based vision therapy, I would guess, when we find out whether there are students who have convergence insufficiency, and that's part of the pilot program. It's interesting that because the report that we talked about, that Ms. Thurman talked about, was reprinted in the ophthalmologist
journal.
And so it is something that the ophthalmologists have been a part of, too. But again, as I say, it's a pilot project. It will be evaluated by the commissioner. She or he will be able to either accept or reject a pilot project request, and so I think it will, and then it will be evaluated 3 years later.
Okay. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, the other concern I have with this bill is it really doesn't talk about, I guess, what you're trying to get at, but also when you look at the evaluation, and you've talked about closing the achievement gap, preventing kids or moving kids out of special ed, cost savings, none of that's included in the evaluation section. It just says they must report, I'm just trying to find it here, an evaluation of the pilot project. And from what I've seen from the Minnesota mm-hmm. Department of Education, if there's money attached, like $1 million, it's going to work. And I'm concerned that we haven't laid out enough of our goals and what we define as success for this pilot project. And I would hope that if this does move into inclusion, that we take a look at that and identify more specifically the types of outcomes or the levels of change that we'd like to see, and have them also develop a test and control project so that we can really look at it and make a good determination.
Thank you, and Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, we will look at trying to do that if it moves forward.
Yeah. Quorum's present. Thank you, Senator Johnson, and testifiers. And Senate File 652 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Claussen, we have three bills from you. Senate Files 916, 630, and 1848. We'll take them in that order. Or if you'd like to alter that, that's your decision. And we ask that testifiers join you as soon as you are ready. Welcome, everybody.
Well, good morning, Chair Wigger and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 916, a proposal to provide grant opportunities to develop teacher-powered schools. And there is no one definition for a teacher-powered school since there is no one model. A shared value of teacher-powered schools is that decisions are made by those working most closely with students, cultivated through a collaborative school governance structure. Teacher-powered schools give teachers the autonomy to make decisions influencing the success of a school. Teachers control critical decisions about teaching and learning to design and run schools, making decisions on curriculum, budget, selecting personnel, and are accountable for the results. You have in your packet of materials there a frequently asked questions handout on teacher-empowered schools that has been made available to you. And with us today offering testimony on their vision for teacher-powered schools are Dr. Lisa Snyder, Lakeville Public School Superintendent. And I'll start with Dr. Snyder, and the other testifiers will introduce themselves as they come forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Snyder.
Good morning, Chairman, committee members. Thank you for having me here this morning. As Senator Claussen mentioned, I'm Lisa Snyder from Lakeville Area Public Schools, superintendent there, just finishing my fourth year. In the last 3 to 4 years, we have really focused on creating a culture of innovation. And the only way you can create a culture of innovation is by empowering teachers. Everyone, all human beings, want to be a part of creating something great. And when you engage teachers in that work, it's amazing the passion that comes forward. And you don't, you know, you look across the United States and you do not see a lot of schools or districts empowering teachers to the level that we are trying to accomplish and engage our teachers in. But if you look internationally, you'll see some great examples. A look to Japan, for example. For years, those teachers have been allowed to do lesson study, where they continually improve their lessons, make them more engaging for students, and continue to get better results. In Finland, which is right now known as one of the best educational systems internationally, the best and the brightest teachers have the highest level of autonomy to create the learning environments for the students. We need that kind of culture in our American public schools. As I mentioned at the beginning, for the last 3 years, we have been creating a culture of innovation. What has that resulted in? What can I tell you in the last 3 to 4 years has happened in Lakeville? And what is all attributed to teachers? I'll tell you this. Lakeville South High School now has a STEM Academy that was non-existent 3 years ago, completely created by teachers, allowing students to have a pathway to the best STEM careers and the best STEM colleges. At Lakeville North, not existent 3 years ago, we now have a business academy with business mentors helping students to really understand that pathway and how to be entrepreneurial in this new economy. And then finally, probably our shining star is Impact Academy, an elementary 21st century model for elementary students to excel far beyond our wildest imaginations. You walk in there, it is not a compliance system. It is a system alive with learners filled with passion, based on their strengths, doing community service, and achieving at levels we did not know could exist. Right now, we're celebrating a kindergarten going into first grade where not one single student isn't at a proficiency level in reading. We have never seen that before in any kindergarten class going to first grade in Lakeville schools until this year. And that is
because
we are providing a wonderful environment for kids, thanks to a group of teachers that spent a lot of time developing this program. If we had access to a grant, just imagine the more teachers that could be creating things like that. Those are teachers that took it upon themselves and spent a lot of extra time to create something great out of the goodness of their heart. But we need to incentivize and provide real grants and opportunities for teachers to dream and to be able to do these incredible things. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Snyder. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Megan Olivia Hall, and I'm the 2013 Minnesota Teacher of the Year. It's a pleasure to see you all again after our conversation last year, and thank you, Senator Wigger, for hosting the Minnesota Teacher of the Year hearing, and also for allowing me to speak today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my school, which does feature some teacher leadership, and then about why I believe that we should make this bill a priority. I teach at a charter-like magnet school in St. Paul Public Schools, and our school is small by design. It's attentive to students and their families, peaceful, and focused on deeper learning. And most of the families that choose our school list charters as the only other options they will consider for their children. Charter enrollment has doubled in Minnesota in the past decade. For years, two children have applied for every one spot in our school, and St. Paul Public Schools could easily fill another school just like ours, or maybe two or three more. Families value the commitment to equity and wraparound services that large districts can offer, not to mention the teacher expertise that flourishes under strong teacher contracts and rigorous professional development. The teachers at my school work like small business owners and not like employees of a large corporation. This bill, which is supported by the St. Paul Teachers Union, the Minneapolis Teachers Union, and the Lakeville Teachers Union presidents, would keep creative self-starters like us in the teaching profession, and it would allow experienced self-directed teachers to create the kind of learning environment that Minnesotan families are seeking. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Claussen, additional testifiers?
Good morning, Chair and Senate here. Julene Oxton is my name. I'm a teacher in Lakeville, and I am the lead developer of Impact Academy. I'm very excited to share a little bit about why I think this bill should be something you consider. I have been in process with eight different teachers, one of them being myself, that have designed Impact Academy. We did that because of the challenges of education. I've been in education for 30 years, way before we had No Child Left Behind or outcome-based education or even standards. So I've lived through it, and I believe that teachers know how to transform education. I've watched it the last 4 years, and they are in the trenches, and they know what kids need. And right now, the way the system is in America, we don't have a lot of decision-making power. Teachers right now are, in the traditional model, basically being able to make decisions around their daily activity with students, but we don't get a lot of opportunities to talk about how we use staff or money or time or schedules. And this bill would allow teachers to be able to redesign the systems, mm-hmm. and that's what Impact Academy has done. Has it been easy? No. But if this bill was passed, it would give incentive to teachers and be able to make it easier for them to get involved because they're ready, and they would love to transform the educational system. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Claussen, a couple years ago we passed a law that allowed for site-based governance, and I remember John Benson, the representative from my area, who's now retired, that was his initiative, and he's, you know, been very excited about it. And I'm wondering what is distinct about this compared to that, and doesn't that provision allow for the very thing that this bill is setting forward? So in other words, why do we need this, given we have passed that?
Sure.
Chair Clausen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boniff, actually, my former days as a principal, going back 25 years, we had site-based management in the district in which I worked. So I had a site council of parents, teachers, students that met monthly. And so we had a lot of shared decision-making. I think what we're proposing here, teacher-powered schools, goes beyond that and gives more governance power to teachers. And I think that's the distinct difference. The site-based management was a step in this direction, but this carries it another step forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Is there anyone in the audience that'd like to testify? Mr. Nathan, and then we'll have Senator Weber's question following your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Nathan. I've been a public school teacher, administrator, PTA parent, and activist in this state for 45 years. I want to make a brief comment about the historic nature of today's hearing. There is a lot of discussion over the last 40 years about how to improve public education. And as you have heard, teachers in traditional districts have a good deal of power over what happens in their individual classroom. This takes it a step forward. According to the Education Commission of the States, this bill would be another national first. This is a bill, going back to what Senator Boniff asks, that would provide some startup funds, not funds to continue. That's the responsibility of the district. This would be the first time a state legislature anywhere in the United States provides money to help teachers within traditional districts, such as you've certainly heard from this morning, create new kinds of options within the district. It is historic. It is a huge opportunity, and I believe, finally, it is a statement on the part of the legislature. We believe that teachers have great ideas, and we're willing to put some money behind that. Hopefully, other organizations would follow suit, but this is a historic bill. So thank you for considering it.
Thank you. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just curious, Senator Clausen, the startup costs and that, what kind of costs are involved in terms of starting this program?
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, I think I'd like the superintendent to respond to that because I think each district is going to be establishing their own plan, and I think it's best to hear from the superintendent.
Dr. Snyder?
Of course, it really depends on what teachers are creating, but I'll give you some examples. So Impact Academy basically did a ton of curriculum and redesign work. So they took all of the standards. They have a multi-age environment that's based on benchmarking, so students can achieve 2 years' growth in 1 year easily in Impact Academy because we don't limit them to grade levels. So since our curriculum is based on grade levels, they needed to redesign to be sure that all the assessments and all the essential learning was aligned. That was a lot of time and commitment. Their service learning component really involved getting partners in the community, so that was a lot of outreach and getting people excited about what the kids could be doing in our community to help and to provide service. So really it's more time because above and beyond their jobs, they're spending an inordinate amount of time creating something new. You know, when I look at the STEM Academy or the Business Academy, there was some capital costs as well. Because the STEM Academy, we didn't have all the equipment we needed and some of those kinds of things. We've had to look to business partners to help us out with and kind of beg, borrow, and steal to be able to get the little bit of equipment that we have. And we're continuing to move forward in that area. But some startup money on some of these ideas would be incredible to really kind of exponentially move them forward.
Any further questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about what it means on line 1.10 where it says a launch school means a school newly created under this section. Could you explain what newly created is?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, in the lines 1.10 through 1.15, there are different levels that we're looking at. And the launch school would be a newly created school, like the academy, I think, that they're talking about here. That wasn't in existence until they decided to look at teacher-powered schools and moving in that direction. So that provides kind of a three-tiered approach, if you will, looking at how to implement the program.
Sir Kickmar.
Thank you. Then how, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Senator Claussen, how is this different then from a charter school? You have a launch school, newly created school. How is that different from a charter school, which is often also very teacher-led?
Yes, Senator Wieger and Senator Kiffmeyer, I think that the difference is in the governance. Here we're looking at a teacher-governed school. Now, not all charters are the same, and I think you're correct in stating that many of them are moving in that direction. But I think that the major difference is the governance of the school rests with the teachers.
Do you mind if I address that?
Yes, please.
All right. Our adventure and journey that impacted...
For the tape, please restate your name, Ms. Oxton.
Oh, I'm sorry. Julene Oxton, Lakeville teacher.
Thank you.
I just wanted to let you know to address the difference between charter and this type of bill is for me and our team, it was all about how many students we could reach. So in a charter school, my understanding is that you become self-governed. You're a public school, but you get to govern yourself. And that's actually where we were heading because we did not even think it was possible to change the system within the system. So as a teacher, if you're looking to do really innovative things, your first thought is charter schools because that's been around for 20-some years. So we actually started on that adventure. And then once we came to the point of needing an authorizer and were very forthright with the district we worked in, I went to Dr. Snyder and told her what we were going to do. And from that meeting forward, it became actually a dream that maybe we could do this innovation within the district we worked. And I can't tell you how affirming that is as a teacher, that your leadership and the system is allowing you to be able to create what and design things the way that you know would be best for students. I've done this a long, long time, and that was the first yes I ever got. So my conclusion between charter and a site-governed or a teacher-empowered school within a district, they are very different. And the reason I think they're different is not because of the autonomy. It's because of the system. If you're being able to do something inside of a system, there's hope that we could transform the whole system. Charter schools intended that. But in my opinion, charter schools are doing innovative things, but they're not spreading the way that my hope is. Because this is for all students in America. It's not just for a few kids that parents get to pick charter schools. We need to transform this whole system. And I really believe that teacher-empowered schools could do that in a very different way than charter schools have been.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes. One other question, maybe the fiscal staff. Mm-hmm. How do you fund if it's – so do they just get the per pupil that would go with the system school then? Is that kind of how that works, other than the startup cost?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, so the bill creates a new subdivision inside the site-governed school section, mm-hmm. and revenue to a site-governed school is defined in subdivision 3 of that section if you're looking for additional reading. But in summary, the district, the site sort of generates revenue in the usual way, except that the district can, by agreement with the site, retain some costs for, like, shared services of a finance office, mm-hmm. of a superintendent, et cetera. So the site-governed school doesn't change the way the revenue is calculated, in short answer.
Well, that's always a good answer. Thank you.
Senator Stump, then Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So really, the site-based management we have in statute right now, why can't this be done right now?
Well, Superintendent Snyder.
Yes, sir. Sure. I think it can be. It can be done right now. I mean, we're certainly moving ahead with our innovations and doing things and trying to be creative about how to fund those things and honor the people that are doing the work. I think this is partially about acknowledging that this work needs to be done, and you're supporting that need for to make it happen. You know, I think just look at the numbers, how many people are utilizing that law and actually moving forward, and can we ask ourselves why perhaps they're not? What are the barriers? So how do we encourage and incentivize groups of teachers to take that level of authority since they have all of that accountability on them as well?
Sir Stone?
Is the reason that it's not being done right now found on line 1.16? Which is really the approval of the board, or is the reason that it's not being done now is that the teacher initiative and that site isn't really, you know, working?
You know, everyone's going to have a different opinion on that. I think in some cases it might be a school board afraid of what does that really mean? What does that really look like? When you're talking about creating an innovative program or a redesign, I think that's more compelling along with the governance versus just the governance. The law really just talks about the governance, the site-based governance, not that we're expecting a redesign and improvement. So I think school boards would be much more open to applying that law and utilizing if it had the power of some of the words in here that we're really asking teachers to redesign, not just self-govern, but to improve our schools across Minnesota.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Claus, as one of your co-authors, I've kind of gotten a little bit confused over the governance aspect of this as the discussion's gone on. With the site-based school being within the public independent school district, is the school still accountable to the superintendent and board?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, Superintendent Snyder can probably answer that, but My looking at the bill and my intent was that, yes, they're still under the auspice of the superintendent and the Board of Education.
If it's okay, I would add to that a little bit.
Superintendent Snyder.
I actually love that unique relationship because I feel like I'm the cheerleader for Impact Academy, and I'm there to make sure that they're successful. I have a stake in it. If they were completely a site-governed school and we just gave them complete autonomy and they didn't have some level of accountability to the Board of Education and to the superintendent, I don't think that's the intention. I think it's the creating this dynamic relationship, a win-win relationship, where you're redesigning and you're really showing that accountability and that relationship for each other.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? Mr. Johnson, I knew you were going to come up at some point. We thank you for your long history of involvement.
Kurt Johnson with Education Evolving. I just wanted to add a brief additional response to what the senator and the superintendent said in response to Senator Stump and Senator Bonhoff. This bill is essentially adding on to those amendments you passed in 2009. And Education Evolving did last year one of the first ever national surveys of teachers to find out what level of interest there was in accepting responsibility for a whole school. We were astonished at the results. Almost three-fourths of all teachers in America said this was either a good or a great idea, and a fifth of them were ready to do it tomorrow morning. So what this bill essentially does is take your 09 amendments about site govern and add some money to it that is roughly the equivalent of what people starting charters get. So it's financial support for planning, financial support for startup. And in a way, you can think of this as an opportunity or equity bill because it allows teachers inside a district to do the same thing people starting charter schools can do. And in effect, it tests the proposition. How much interest is there among teachers? We've talked to thousands of teachers, hundreds in Minnesota, and the number one reason why the 09 amendments are not used is not recalcitrant boards or head-in-the-sand union leaders. It's lack of financial support to pay for the planning and startup phase. So this is a modest amount of money to test the proposition to find out how much interest is there among teachers in Minnesota to do this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And thank you to the testifiers for your inspiration, your passion for this, and the proven results thus far in trying to replicate this into something for all schools. Senator Claussen, Senate File 916 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll go next to Senate File 630, Early Education, Homeless, and we do have an A2 amendment. I believe that's at everyone's place. And members will recall that we had a lot of testimony in policy on the need for this, and so Senator Claussen, we have in our other capacity as policy committee have heard the, you know, the background. We could perhaps, you know, highlight the need again, but we have heard testimony. Maybe, you know, focus on some highlights and then open for any questions. But first, or whenever you'd like, we'll entertain the A2 amendment, the author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make some introductory comments and then get to the A2 amendment. Again, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today regarding Senate File 630. It's a bill to grant young homeless children ages birth to 3 access to the Part C early intervention services. Part C of IDEA, the Individuals and Disabilities Education Act, provides early intervention services for infants and toddlers with disabilities and has been a part of IDEA since 1986. And I'd like to point out that currently low birth weight babies and fetal alcohol babies are automatically eligible for Part C services, and Senate File 630 places homelessness within this category of children that are not given necessarily a special education label at an early age, but receive services as a proactive initiative. And Mr. Chair, as you stated earlier, at this time I'd like to offer the A2 amendment, and the amendment really clarifies language in response to Senator Hoffman's concerns. You may recall he voiced some concerns, and there have been meetings taking place with Senator Hoffman, and so that amendment clarifies that.
Okay. On the A2 amendment, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. We have Senate File 630 as amended. Please proceed.
Well, unfortunately, the achievement gap for many homeless children begins at birth. Senate File 630 provides special instruction and services for homeless children ages birth to 3 living in conditions with a high probability of resulting in a developmental delay. And a developmental delay is a significant lag in a children's physical, cognitive, behavioral, emotional, or social development in comparison with norms. Developmental delays include problems with speech and language, motor and fine motor abilities, and personal and social development. National studies document that many homeless children experience developmental delays due to multiple risk factors. In one study, more than half, 54% of homeless preschoolers had a major developmental delay, and many of those children had multiple delays. Committee members may recall the compelling testimony of Dr. Ann Mastin from the University of Minnesota, and she identified the risk factors and characteristics of homeless children. And many of her studies have been conducted in partnership with the Minneapolis Public Schools. And Dr. Mastin, unfortunately, could not be with us today, but has provided the packet of information for your review. And Senator and Chair, I think probably the best thing to do, rather than go into additional testimony that is perhaps a review of Dr. Mastin's work, we should just go to our testifiers, and I'd like to introduce Peggy Flanagan, Executive Director, Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota, as our first testifier.
Thank you. And again, if we can highlight testimonies, as we did have an excellent presentation in policy, but reiterating highlights at this point would be helpful. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Peggy Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. Thanks for allowing me to testify. Thank you, Senator Claussen, for bringing this bill forward, and to Senators Wieger, Nienau, Rosen, and Sharon for co-authoring this very important legislation. As you know, again, Part C early intervention, which falls under the IDEA, is an effective program for infants and toddlers who have a developmental delay or who have a physical or mental condition that is likely to result in a developmental delay. Part C services, which include physical or occupational therapy for gross or fine motor development delay, speech therapy for speech delay, or many other services for other types of delay, are coordinated and delivered through a child's school district. Early intervention services are delivered in the child's natural environment, usually the child's home, with the parents or caregivers as an active participant in the therapy sessions. MDE, the lead agency for Part C, works with DHS and MDH to find eligible young children to develop services. One of the difficulties for Part C can be finding infants and toddlers and their families who traditionally have very few connections to the school district and very few connections generally. As such, there are about one dozen interagency early intervention committees throughout the state who work to connect with families who may have an eligible child. And we strongly believe in this program and want to ensure that children and their families can connect with these critical services. According to one 2009 MinLink study, one-third of children who received Part C services did not actually need special education services by second or third grade. CDF and the Visible Child Initiative for Family Housing Fund believe that Part C program can be especially beneficial for young children who are homeless. And we know that our homeless infants and toddlers experience developmental delays at more than four times the rate of other children. 54% of homeless infants and toddlers have a developmental delay, and the majority have a delay in more than one domain. As a result of our legislation that CDF and the Visible Child Initiative brought in 2013, MDE now tracks and reports to the legislature the number of homeless infants and toddlers referred to Part C. According to their first report, which was published in July, eight infants and toddlers were referred to the program. However, according to Wilder Research 2012 study, 840 infants and toddlers are homeless on any given night. So we're missing a large swath of children who need these services. One way to make homeless children visible and help to ensure they receive the critical early intervention services to make them eligible for Part C is through an at-risk definition of developmental delay to an environmental or behavioral risk. A handful of other states have expanded their Part C eligibility to include children who are homeless, though it is important to note that most states require that that more than one risk factor is present to be eligible. That being said, the trauma of homelessness almost always means that children have experienced a multitude of risk factors during their young lives. Poverty, witnessing domestic violence, having a parent with an undiagnosed or untreated mental illness, and living without safe or stable housing. The 2012 report from the Humphrey Institute, Mothering While Homeless, a qualitative analysis of access to child services by young mothers in Hennepin County, captures the experience of homeless mothers aged 18 to 24 of children aged 0 to 5. The primary takeaway from this report is that mothers in the report have a deep desire to take an active role in the healthy development of their child. Those of us who are parents absolutely want the best for our children. We should expect no less from children, from parents of young children experiencing homelessness. Part C empowers parents to take an active role in the development of their child. Part C is an important component of the early childhood continuum of services and a critical piece of the school readiness puzzle. And we believe that this is especially the case for infants and toddlers who are homeless. We look forward to working with you to ensure that infants and toddlers are on track to meet developmental milestones so they can have healthy childhoods and productive adulthoods. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak to the committee. My name is Sharon Henry Blythe. I'm the director of the Visible Child Initiative, a program of the Family Housing Fund. And this morning, I brought with you a copy of a report prepared by Kevin Overson and Scott McConnell at the University of Minnesota that I believe does an excellent job of really laying out Part C, what's possible, what criteria would allow these young children to be identified as eligible for Part C early intervention services. I won't go into a lot of detail in this report, but in particular, on page 4, at the last three paragraphs, I think they do an excellent job of really stating what the law allows and why homeless children are eligible. As Senator Clausen and Peggy have said, over 50% of homeless children are identified as being behind in developmental milestones. Part C is a clear and proven early intervention service that can help address these issues and really prepare these young children for success in preschool and later in kindergarten. At this point in the discussion, I feel it's important to say that if these children are falling between the cracks right now, they are not accessing available early childhood services. Homelessness means that the trauma that they're experiencing is exacerbated day by day. And if we don't take steps right now to embrace these young children, provide services, then we are going to continue to lament the achievement gap and the challenges that many children face, poor children face when they get into public school. I argue that that Part C is an opportunity for us to close this gap before our young children get into kindergarten. And if this is not, and this is a proven program, if this is not what we're willing to do, then what are we willing to do? Then is a question that I have for myself and for the committee members. Thank you.
Thank you. We have representative from the Department of Education like to testify. And also, I see Ms. Fitzsimmons is listed. If she wanted to testify as well, but whoever would like to testify next, and then we'll open up for any questions and then lay it over. Mr. Uni.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Adosh Uni. I am the Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Department of Education. The Department of Education has been in contact with the advocates and with the author here and in the House on some of the concerns that we have with the way the language is written. But first of all, we want to say that we strongly believe that this is an issue that needs focus. This is a population of students that definitely needs help. And one of the solutions that we thought might help is the Interagency Coordinating Council met in early March and discussed this issue. They haven't made any formal recommendations, but one of their thoughts was that a work group should be convened to look at this issue to get all of the stakeholders' input and come to some consensus about a solution. Some of the problems that we see that are highlighted in this approach is that early childhood special educators may not have the appropriate training to serve students experiencing homelessness. As the experiences that they're currently trained for with developmental delays and homelessness are significantly different. ECSE is currently identified as a teacher shortage area, so there may be a workforce capacity issue to serve this expanded group. This shortage area as well, because of the potential lack of training, may have some unintended consequences in the services for this expanded group, as well as may have an adverse impact on the population that's currently being serviced by this teacher corps. And unfortunately, special education labels may carry a certain stigma. And since being homeless is not necessarily the same as being diagnosed with a developmental delay, it may not be the best to identify these homeless students as disabled. So just to reiterate, the department believes that this is an important issue and that the Interagency Coordinating Council's informal recommendation of convening a work group to look at this issue may be the best approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, and welcome back to each of you. Mr. Uni, part of your presentation was upstaged, definitely, with respect. Yes, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I've worked with many of you before in different capacities. I'm actually not here today on behalf of an organization. I'm here today as a parent, and this is Giovanni Fitzsimmons, my little boy who's 15 months old. We live in Stillwater with my husband and our four-year-old son. And we're here today to talk to you about the Part C program and how important that program has been in our life. So I'd like to do two things. I'd first like to tell you just a little bit in the brief time we have about Giovanni, and then I'd like to tell you about our experience with the Part C program. When Giovanni was about 3 months old, he's 15 months now, we noticed that he wasn't using his hands or his arms or his legs or his feet like we thought he should be doing. And so we checked in with our pediatrician, and he said, you know, I trust your instincts. I trust your parenting knowledge, and why don't you watch it and we'll see what happens. And so he went to check back in a month, and about a week later I called him and said, you know, Dr. Corey, I'm not really comfortable doing that. I said I'd like to move forward with what the other steps are. I won't go through what all the medical challenges are, but Giovanni has seizures. He has what's called hypotonia, which is low muscle tone all throughout his body. He also has decreased muscle strength all throughout his body. He has what's called a carnitine deficiency, which is partly a metabolic disorder. And we are waiting now over about a year for a final diagnosis, and we're waiting on a second round of genetic testing results to come back from Texas to know exactly what we're looking at. As you can see, he's able to use his hands and his arms. He crawled for the first time last week. He's not able to stand. He's not able to pull to stand. But with Part C, which is the second part and the most important part for today that I want to talk to you about, is our experience with that program. The program has been instrumental for Giovanni and for our family. And when we say our prayers at night, we thank for our doctors and our nurses, and we thank for Barb and Mary and Terry, who we work with through the Stillwater Public School District. Terry is the early childhood coordinator. Mary is a physical therapist, and Barb is his occupational therapist through the school district, which they also contract through Courage Center. So she's actually a Courage Center employee. Since May, we've been working with therapists through the school district about once a week during the summer. They only have services one week a month. But so now we're through the school district once a week. And I just want to give you an idea of some of the things that we've learned through therapy and how it works. So they come to our home, usually the same time every week, and work with Giovanni in the environment that he's used to and that he's familiar with. And they watch, and they show primarily me. I've been at every therapy session, but they show me different exercises that I can do with Giovanni throughout the week. And what we've learned is that repetition is very important. So, for example, when we were working on having him be able to sit up, when babies have low tone, when they have hypotonia, it's difficult for them to raise up and keep their head up straight. So we would lay him down, have him hold on to our thumbs, and he would pull up, trying to get his head straight. So we would do that 10 times every time we changed his diaper. Something else that was difficult for Giovanni, even though we did tummy time from the time that he was little, it was very difficult for him to be able to support himself on his forearms. So we took the cushion from the couch, we put it on the floor, we put a blanket over it, and then I'm on one side of it and he's on the other. So he's building up that strength. Something else we have, I don't know if he'll show them to you, but these are shorts that Barb gave us, and they're sewn down the middle. Because with his low tone, he's not able to keep his legs together or his knees together. So as we're working on kneeling and working on helping him pull up, if we can keep his little legs together for him, it's one less thing that he has to do as he's strengthening his core and trying to master those skills. And just two other quick things on the Part C program to share. When last September he was able to wave for the first time, and I took a picture and I sent it to Mary, who's our physical therapist, and I said, thank you. It's pretty amazing when you can see your child wave for the first time when you don't think they're going to be able to use their hands. And then when he crawled for the first time, he actually crawled during therapy with Barb the day after my birthday, which wound up being a fantastic present. So we are very grateful for the services that we've received through the school district. The two last things that I'd like to share with you, one, when my husband and I were making the decision to call early intervention, my husband, my mother-in-law, his mom is a retired elementary school special ed teacher from Prior Lake, and my husband was worried about having Giovanni labeled as having a disability or needing special ed services. And we talked through it quite a bit, and I did a lot of listening, and we came to the place of we need to do whatever we can right now while he's a baby, while he's a toddler, to intervene here as early as possible to make certain that he's where he can be and where he needs to be. And if that happens, if there's a stigma, if he's treated differently, if he's labeled during preschool or later, we'll deal with that when it comes. But right now, the most important thing is to get him these services. The last thing I want to say is that through much of my life, through church as a child, as an adult, through the work that I've done with Legal Aid and Children's Defense Fund, I've become friends with, talked with, sat with, had meals with, prepared meals for lots of families who are homeless. And one of the things that I have heard from primarily moms is when they talk about their children and the joy they have when they talk about being a mom and watching the things that their children do. And now that I'm a mom and sitting down and having some of those same conversations, we have some of the same experiences as far as the stress of transitions. Granted, I cannot imagine or fathom what it has to be like to transition as a homeless mom with your children. But that being said, I really urge you to first think of these moms as moms, because you're primarily talking about moms here who you'll be working with through the Part C program and their children. And I also urge you to not make those moms or those young children wait any longer to receive these services through this incredible program that we know works to change these little ones' lives and the lives of their family. So thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Simmons. What powerful, inspirational testimony you and Giovanni, and you've touched our hearts, and thank you so much for being here. You did real well, Giovanni. Okay. Our youngest testifier of the session. Okay. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. But I do have a question for Ms. Henry, and I'd like to ask her to come back. Ms. Henry, thank you so much for your work. I would like to ask you a question. I think you heard the department say that we need to have a study to figure out what to do. And I was shocked to hear that. I think you've done a significant number of reviews and studies. I think that's the reason you're here to ask for this support. Do you believe that we need to study this issue farther? I think that this study that you provided gave us a very compelling argument. 50% of the children who are homeless are African American. 50%. I just don't think that we need more information. I think we have enough information. So I would like to ask you, could you tell us a little bit more about the families that live in shelters? And this report talks about how families don't have access to shelters and the transitions that families have to make, and how, you know, they tomorrow they don't know where they are going to be, and how children are missing school. But you know, the issue of school is compelling, and the argument is strong. But the majority of these children are between 1 and 5. So could you tell us what is that we need to do very concretely to the Department of Education, that we don't need to study these anymore? Very concretely, what is that we need to do?
Well, Sharon Henry Blythe, thank you for Senator Clausen and Senator Torres-Ray. You know, I gave the idea of a work group some thought, and I have decided that we have enough information. We have the University of Minnesota, Dr. Mazden, Wilder Research. We have a lot of information. We have the report from the Department of Education that identifies the number of children, homeless children, that were who received services through Part C in the last year. So there is quite a bit of data. In terms of what we need to do, real practical steps, I think the Interagency Coordinating Council is an excellent vehicle that can be used, and the various sites around the state, the Child Find sites around the state. With additional support, I think we can be much more effective in identifying and locating families with young, homeless families with young children, 0 to 2 years old. I think that the time and the effort that is going to take is going to be something that this policy will help address. Supporting the committees around the state is one thing. If staff need training to understand, feel more confident in their ability to provide early intervention services with families who have young children and are homeless, Minnesota is one of the best states in the United States that around research and practice around trauma and family, complex trauma and supporting young early childhood development. The University of Minnesota has a tremendous amount of resources that can be made available. And lastly, I will mention to understand the differences between how where families are in greater Minnesota versus in the metro area. We know, we have a lot of information. It is legwork, it's time, it's intensity, and that's what we're asking for, I believe, in this law.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and I'd like to ask a question of Mr. Uni, please. I'm reading the executive summary from Kevin Overson and Scott McConnell, and with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act saying that children 0 to 3 in the United States with conditions with a high probability of resulting in a developmental delay are eligible. And what they say is that they don't have to demonstrate a need. In other words, as I'm reading this, and maybe I'm reading it wrong, is that if a child is found to be homeless, they are considered to be eligible for Part C services. And in the last paragraph, it says, and the state of Minnesota must act to provide these services. So it can't be if we have enough money. It says, that's what I interpret, is that we must do that. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, again, this is Adosha Uni from the Department of Education. I actually have technical staff here to assist with this question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Backer, and it's my privilege to serve the state of Minnesota as the supervisor for the Part C program at the Minnesota Department of Education. The current eligibility as defined within the federal Part C regulations speak to a child with a diagnosed physical or mental condition. So the purpose of that is to make sure that the states effectively and intervene in a timely manner when a young child is born with a condition such as cerebral palsy, a hearing impairment, any other type of physical or mental anomaly that's identifiable very early on. Homelessness is considered an environmental condition as opposed to a diagnosed physical or mental condition. And so we certainly have the option as a state to serve children under an at-risk category, which is the type of category that this particular type of eligibility would fall in the eyes of the federal government.
Mr. Chair, you don't need to respond, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this, but, you know, then we're saying that this information is not in tune with what happens here in Minnesota. And that's what I'd like to discuss with you at some time.
Okay, I'd appreciate that discussion.
Thank you.
Sarah Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. I was reading Dr. Mastin's information here, and she refers to the homeless and highly mobile. And I think Senator Torres already talked about the homeless not knowing exactly where they'll be any given night in that respect, and therefore how does this play into, and how do you handle the child that's homeless and all of a sudden may not consistently be in the same school district? And as a result, because of the transientness of the homeless situation, how are they addressed?
Mr. Chair,
Sarah Clausen,
Senator Weber, for 5 years, I served as the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Contact for the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools. And by federal statute, school districts are required to assist families in maintaining that grounded educational place. And so we would transport students to their home school. That's one of the requirements.
Sam Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But does the uncertainty and maybe the quickness with which their location might change, isn't that still going to pose some interruptions in service?
Yeah. Senator Wieger.
Senator Clausen.
And Senator Weber. It does. Many of these families, you'd have to work very closely because they could be moving a couple times a week. And so providing transportation and scheduling that, it was a daily
daily event for myself and others that I worked with. And a lot of people didn't realize, you know, in a middle-class, upper-middle-class school district, Apple Valley, Rosemont, we could identify over 200 students a year that were homeless that we were assisting. And so they're there, and you've had ample, I think, data and research that we've provided to show that there is a need here. I think also one of the things that is a little bit confusing regarding Senator Johnson's comments, because we do provide Part C assistant services for low birth weight babies. We also do that for fetal alcohol babies. And so at an early age, we start that intervention, and I think homelessness is just one other situation that we need to look at, obviously.
Senator Claussen, thank you, and to each of your testifiers. Various follow-up will be done, as noted. I believe the fiscal notes, approximately $14 million for the biennium. Senate File 630, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you,
next,
Mr. Chair.
We have Senate File 1848, and we ask Mr. Smith to join you. And as he approaches, Senator Bonoff has the next two bills. We'll take 1536 ahead of that for those of you here for that one. Senator Claussen, please proceed with Senate File 1848.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, thank you for the opportunity now to present Senate File 1848. It's a proposal to increase operating capital funding to school districts. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Claussen offers the author's A1 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Adopted. We have Senate File 1848 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And all the A1 amendment does is adjust the effective date to fiscal year 2017. The Minnesota funding formula for operating capital includes an allocation intended for facilities and an allocation intended for equipment, and is a mixture of state aid and local levy funds. Using operating capital for facilities includes acquiring land for school purposes, acquiring or constructing buildings, rent or leasing buildings, and improving and repair school sites and buildings, amongst other things. The operating capital equipment allocation may be used to purchase or lease computers, interactive telecommunications equipment, and related hardware, purchase textbooks and to replace library resources or technology. The operating capital equipment allocation is a critical item for school districts to maintain facilities, and as the need and cost for telecommunications and computer equipment has increased over the years. The operating capital formula has not increased since fiscal year 2001. And this committee received earlier testimony on the recommendations of the School Facilities Finance Work Group. Senator Dahl has a bill there that we discussed at length. The Facilities Finance Work Group studied the need to develop an adequate, equitable, and sustainable financing of public school facilities, and recommendation number 5 of that report calls for an increase in the operating capital revenue and indexing the operating capital formula for inflation. However, the recommendation only restores a portion of the lost revenue buying power to 2006 levels. And Senate File 1848 increases the operating capital revenue allowance by a 2% annual increase since 2001, and this would increase the operating capital levy revenue by, I'm sorry, it would increase the operating capital funding revenue by $25 per pupil unit for equipment and $38 per pupil unit for facilities. And you have been provided an operating capital revenue modifications comparison chart that you can look at, and you can identify the impact to local school districts. And offering testimony is Mr. Larry Smith, business agent for the Rochester Public Schools.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Larry Smith. I'm the Executive Director of Finance for Rochester Public Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning on behalf of the Senate File 1848. As Senator Claussen referred, the operating capital formula as established by Minnesota statute has not increased since fiscal year 2001, except for some formula changes to address hold harmless issues when pupil unit weighting factors have changed. We have lost basically 15 years worth of buying power without having formula changes here. In 2013, legislation was passed requiring the Commissioner of Education to convene a working group to look at finance reform for education facilities. The report that was generated, just a couple of short excerpts from the task force report, states that it's the state's responsibility to give school boards access and to resources to construct and maintain facilities that provide uniform, safe, and healthy environment for every student. Goes on to say that operating capital revenues should be increased to reverse long-term erosion of buying power and provide additional resources for school technology. This proposed 2% increase, basically adjustment per year since 2001, does closely reflect the change in the consumer price index from 2000 to 2014. So it pretty much addresses restoring that lost buying power. In Rochester, we use our operating capital revenue to pay for the personnel cost directly related to acquisition, operation, and maintenance of telecommunication systems and related equipment. About half of our operating capital revenue goes for that purpose. About 25% goes towards the purchase of textbooks and new and replacement library and media resources. An additional allocation goes towards software license and annual license fees there. Though resources available for those purposes has not grown. As the salary and benefit costs increase, the amounts available for other operating capital purposes keep shrinking. We have very little resources available to address, for example, building security improvements or facility modifications necessary to meet programmatic needs. And finally, the issue of increasing technology needs and also the technology replacement. Restoring some of this lost buying power would certainly go a long ways towards addressing those needs. Thank you.
Thank you. And staff has prepared a note showing the impact on districts. That's self-explanatory. If anyone has questions on that. Senator Claussen, and reference was made to Senator Dahl's bill, and the task force that completed its work in 2013 that you referred to, Mr. Smith, did put together a lot of excellent recommendations, and I think that we'd love to implement them. If we did, I would exceed my target right now, and so it's with a great deal of frustration right now as we address this because we know there is a need, but that's going to ultimately be for us to weigh. Is there anyone in the audience that'd like to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I would just like to make a couple of comments. As I'd just like everybody to remember that earlier in session we did have a hearing on technology called Technology as the Conduit to Opportunity and Learning. And this was one of the vehicles that we suggested at this point is to infuse money into the districts that could be used for technology. And so we just wanted to remind you of that. There is the operating capital statute does allow for all sorts of uses of technology, including staff development and whatever the needs may be. So this is a good vehicle for that. And lastly, the last reason I would like to say that I think that this is a good vehicle for technology funding is because it does not compete with money on the formula directly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's great.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Claussen, I agree with where you're going with this bill. The concern I have is the implementation of it, moving it from 2016 to 2017. I think what we've seen is that when we do these partial biennium bills, we get a little bit of a sticker shock in the tails going forward, and we're seeing that in a number of items that were passed in the last biennium. I think one that sticks out to me is all-day kindergarten, where we're going to effectively spend an additional $900 million on a program that you know was not nearly that big. And so if I'm reading this right, we're talking about $37 million in state expense just for 2017, so approximately $74 million for the total biennium. Is that correct?
You know, Mr. Arneson can certainly comment on that, but just to comment on why it went to 2017, that this bill does impact local levies, and because of that, we usually push them out a year. So there is a local levy implementation piece that's connected to this. But, Mr. Arneson, perhaps turning to you for a comment on the fiscal side.
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair and Senators, firstly, Senator Pratt's interpretation of the run is correct, that the aid cost in fiscal 17 is approximately $37 million. And then to Senator Claussen's remarks, one reason to delay the effective date, especially in a budget year, delay the effective date to the second year of the biennium, is that if a bill affects local property tax levies, the levies that would be on an accrual basis counted for revenue in fiscal 16 have already been certified and are being paid this year. So if it would be possible, certainly, to have left this bill in the version that was introduced, but for many districts that would require essentially doubling up on their levy through a prior year adjustment for taxes payable in 2016. And certainly some districts may wish to do that, and others may find that presents quite a significant problem for their taxpayers.
Well, and
Senator Pratt,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and that's a good understanding. You know, I'll again just reiterate my concern that what we're looking at is a huge tails issue, and you know, I've been concerned as we've talked about all day. You know, as we implemented all day kindergarten, as we've talked about implementing school lunch program or school breakfast program, as we've talked about all day, every day free child care. It's just sometimes these initiatives are funded in order to keep the cost down in the current year, and we'll kick the can down the road and deal with the tails and the increased expense. And I think what we're seeing is from last biennium when we did that, we now have a huge fiscal hangover from a very large program that was implemented and underfunded using only 1 year of the biennium and some fairly low assumptions. So I just wanted to bring up for members' consideration, I think it's a good idea. I'm not backing away from that, and I understand the needs from schools. But to understand that this has a long and effectively a doubling of in the tails.
Further discussion? Anyone else in the audience like to testify? If not, Senate File 1848 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Clausen, and thank you, Mr. Smith, for your testimony and service. We'll go next to Senate File 1536, Senator Bonoff, Girls in Action, and we invite your testifiers to join you at the table. That'll be followed by Senate File 1541. Again, Senator Bonoff. And welcome to everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I was introduced to Dr. Price a few months ago. She was in my office sharing about her work, and I will begin my testimony by letting you know that when she told me about the fact that she was currently working with, I believe it was 3,000 girls, and the thing that stood out most to me is she said that the work that she was doing was having those girls have 100% graduation rate. And so I began to ask questions, and really then we developed the idea for this particular bill. So Girls in Action was founded in 2005 with a focus on improving outcomes for women of color beginning in seventh grade and going through high school graduation. Girls in Action provides weekly mentoring and empowerment. Women mentors and leaders work with girls to improve decision-making, self-control, careers, and leadership skills. So this bill seeks state support for this incredible program. With limited resources, it is my belief that we should be putting our emphasis on proven programs. The results speak for themselves. As we know, we have been singled out as having one of the worst achievement gaps in the country between students of color and white students. This program directly addresses this issue. As I heard about the results from Dr. Price, I asked questions like, why isn't the Minneapolis School District using this approach more comprehensively? And what I decided from that conversation is that perhaps the best way to go forward would be to say, let's just pick one school, give Dr. Price all the girls, and see what happens, so that we're not saying, you know, that we're going to spread this everywhere, we're going to scale it up, but in fact, take it down and say, if you in fact work with all these girls in one school, what would the results be? And that's the bill before you. Another comment I wanted to make about the bill before you is the fiscal request. If you look on lines 2.10 and 2.11, I had intended, Mr. Chair, to have the 437,500 be for the biennium, not each year. Okay. So just for your own planning. But now I'd like to introduce Dr. Price.
Thank you so much, Senator Bonoff, and thank you so much for authoring this bill. I so appreciate it. To Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you so much for having us. 10 years ago, I got a call from North High School, and that call went something like this. Our girls are getting into trouble. Our girls are fighting. Our girls are getting suspended. And ultimately, our girls are not achieving academically. And we really need positive role models, women of color, in this school. North High at that time was 95% African-American students. North High happens to be the alumni school of my husband. He attended North High School in North Minneapolis. So when I got the call, I said, absolutely, I will come. So they gathered about 300 girls, and they put them in the auditorium. And they said, okay, now, Dr. Verna, you've got 45 minutes to fix them. Go for it. And they closed the door. And I proceeded to teach the girls about how to understand their personal power and how to change their life. And you don't have to let your circumstances determine your destiny. That resulted in, 10 years later, impacting over 3,000 girls. 8 of those 10 years, I simply did it. I asked the districts for nothing. In the last 2 years, someone finally said to me, Dr. Verna, you've got to ask districts to put something on the table. And I started to ask them. But really, we're really giving the program to the districts. So when Senator Bonoff said, what would happen if we did this for every girl in a school? I said, let's go for it. Let's just make it happen. That would be an amazing experience to infuse amazing women into one school to do this program to help girls understand their personal power, become leaders in their schools and their communities, you know, serve and also help girls to develop a plan. We require every girl, we require them to go to college. We don't ask them if they're going to go to college. We require them to go to college, and then we mentor them as such. So I'm going to stop there and let our girl speak for herself. I've asked Mariah Reynolds from Henry High School to join us and to tell you what Girls in Action has done for her, and she's currently in the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Mariah Reynolds, and I am a senior at Patrick Henry High School. And I just want to share with you a little about why Girls in Action is important to me. Girls in Action is important to me because it has made me realize that I can do anything I want in life. I am powerful, and no one can tell me any different. I am in charge of my life, and no one has the power to misguide me in my decisions that I make on a day-to-day basis except me. Girls in Action has taught me how to value my self-worth and how important I am, that I am beautiful no matter what color, shape, or size, that there is no such thing as a perfect body or person, only a perfect you. Girls in Action has also taught me to make closer connections and advocate for myself. If we want something, we have to go get it. I think that Girls in Action is important for girls in North Minneapolis because it gives us constant support and guidance throughout high school. Girls in Action has taught me so much, and I continue to grow and learn more each day. Thank you.
Thank you. Well done.
Mr. Chair, I would like to point to in your packet, there's some handouts. The Girls in Action Impact, it lists the results of the 10 years of the program's existence. And then I was questioning Dr. Price in great detail about how the dollars would be used if we were able to fund this pilot. And so you've got a handout that lists that. And then if you go back to the bill itself, the objectives of the program are very clearly spelled out in Subdivision 2. It requires the program to meet the following objectives: increase academic performance, graduation rates, and enrollment in post-secondary education, increase knowledge of post-secondary options and preparation, increase mentoring and internship opportunities, as well as career development in STEM fields, provide mentoring, personal development, and leadership training to the families of participants. And then it does require the Commissioner of Education to submit an evaluation reporting on the outcomes of the pilot. So would be our intention that we would take this pilot report back to the legislature, and then I believe the district would be able to look clearly at whether or not they were going to use their resources to invest at a greater rate.
Excellent. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify further on Senate File 1536? Questions of the committee? Well, Senator Bonoff, testifiers, thanks for sharing the inspiring story, the various success stories so far, the way of measuring what you're going to do is clearly stated as well. So, Senator Bonoff, I believe you indicated that your intent that the $437,500 amount would be for the biennium.
Yes.
So that author's amendment would be made by staff. And Senate File 1536, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much. And next, we have Senator Bonoff, Senate File 1541, regarding foreign exchange students. We ask testifiers to please join Senator Bonoff at the table. And a new fiscal note's being distributed, Senator Bonoff, right now.
Thank you very much.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. While it is with pride and some difficulty that I sit beside my now good friend, Cheryl Hill, the founder of ClearCause, I was approached by Cheryl last session as she shared her personal tragedy, how she and her husband is here as well, Alan, how they lost their son during a people-to-people program. And that when that happened, Cheryl really went on a mission. And she began to uncover troubling information regarding study abroad programs, a lack of regulation, a lack of oversight, and truly no disclosure reporting or insurance requirements. And so last session, members, we took this on at the college level, and we passed a study abroad bill that regulated those study abroad programs that affected the post-secondary institutions. And we put a bill in place and is right now underway that requires those programs to report safety statistics to a one-stop database that students and families can access prior to enrolling in a program. In general, we set forward a process whereby our students can report and that information is now on, will be on the Office of Higher Ed's website as well as the Secretary of State's website. However, that particular law that we passed didn't even really impact Cheryl's situation, because when he passed away, he was participating in a people-to-people program while he was in high school. So Senate File 1541 outlines necessary reporting requirements for those programs that that are offered in high school. Our current law regulates foreign students who come to Minnesota to study in our schools. However, we don't regulate those students who do go abroad. So before I take you through the bill, I'd like to just give Cheryl an opportunity to share her story, and then we've also are joined by Mr. Abdul Azim to share his experience.
And thank you, Senator Boff, and we do have your author's amendment whenever
thank
you're
you.
Ready. Okay, and welcome, Ms. Helen.
Thank you. Chairman Wieger, honorable members of the committee, and my leader and role model, Senator Bonoff, thank you for this landmark Hallmark bill. The world is listening. The nation is listening. Other states will follow. I am Cheryl Hill, and I am the founder of Clear Cause Foundation. We are on a mission to save lives and protect our students abroad. I am also the proud mom of two sons and host mom of more than 8 international youth for more than 12 years. When the opportunity came to send our son Tyler, who was barely 16, on a student trip to Japan with people-to-people student ambassadors, we wanted to give him the world. And we did our homework and personal best to vet out that program and to keep him safe. We believe the program's claim of a solid safety record and no deaths in more than 50 years. Our son, barely 16, was an A honor student. He was a hero at his school for single-handedly reporting a bomb threat. Tyler was a leader and a role model. He earned MVP on U19 rugby. He died a preventable death on a people-to-people trip to Japan in 2007. Tyler would be alive today if he had received timely and appropriate medical attention. Tyler was not the first, nor is he the only death on a people-to-people trip. The student tourism industry encourages our most precious assets, our children, to go abroad. But there is no requirement for them to disclose anything about their safety record to Minnesota schools, parents, or anyone, anywhere. Young Minnesotans who die or are irreparably harmed on student programs in foreign countries are invisible. Their deaths and their injuries are not even a meaningful statistic. Animals and coffee beans have more protective legislation than our kids on exotic student travel trips. Student tourism is a massive $200-plus billion industry operating with no state or federal protective laws whatsoever. The World Youth Student Travel Confederation invites you to tap into this lucrative industry. Our kids have become commodities. Chaperones are told to get 10 to pay to go, and you can go for free. There was no way for us to know that the program had prior fatalities. There is no way for you to know how many Minnesota students have been hurt or killed, robbed, raped, starved, abandoned on these school programs. Poor providers must be stopped from providing poorly, and that's why I'm honored and privileged and humbled to have Tyler Hill's death become a legacy to protect other youth. We founded Clear Cause because we wanted to help others. A Minnesota school has disclosed to me that despite the United States Department of State warnings and alerts that their students were placed in Honduras. Honduras is known as one of the highest homicide countries in the world. These kids were middle school students. A Minnesota mom called me in angst because her daughter and others did not get timely medical attention from Guatemala after several of them had been infected with dengue fever. On arrival in Texas, this mother's daughter, along with many other students, were hospitalized for more than a week. That daughter and her peers have residual joint pain that affect their quality of life. Failure to provide timely and appropriate medical attention to a child in the state of Minnesota is a criminal offense. It is not a criminal offense for our chaperones to fail to provide health care, food, and appropriate shelter to students in foreign countries. Another Minnesota mother phoned me tearfully, reporting that her high school daughter was groped sexually in an elevator by two European men on a high school band trip. When she tried to report it, the program blamed her daughter
stopped returning phone calls. On a broader scale, I work with families throughout America whose kids have been killed, waivers are shoved under their noses, and they're told, sign this or you're not going to get our help, you're not going to get your school credits, you won't graduate if you continue, and you're not going to get your money back. When these kids die, very often, families are left to their own resources to repatriate their bodies. Insurance is not required. These kids are our future. We must ensure their safety. I will never look into my son's eyes, hear his voice, or kiss his face again. I'm asking you, I'm pleading with you. This bill has to pass. We have other states watching. I have the attention of the White House, Department of State, and Department of Ed. We are creating a legacy here that is going to save lives and protect students around the world. Please say yes for transparency. I'm asking you to vote yes to stop poor providers from providing poorly. I'm asking you to say yes so that other states can follow your leadership and other countries, ours. Vote yes so that parents can make informed decisions about safety for their child in foreign countries. Vote yes so that your children, my children, our children, come back with school credits instead of a coffin. Vote yes to save lives and protect our greatest assets, our future, our students, and I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hill, for your work.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, before I go on to the other testifier, I would just briefly like to review the bill before us. So I would like to move the author's amendment.
Okay, Senator Bonoff moves the author's A1 amendment. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted.
Thank you. And, you know, I have worked with Cheryl for the past couple years on this, and so it never is easy to have this conversation, and so I want to thank her for her courage in continuing to be with us to bring this forward. So we can't imagine the pain that must occur whenever. So anyways, if you look at Section 1, Section 1 outlines the necessary reporting requirements. Current law that regulates foreign students who come to Minnesota study in our schools is regulated by the Secretary of State. And so we actually are working with the Secretary of State in Minnesota, who has been very generous in terms of being willing to expand their reporting to register the high school programs as well. So this new law seeks to regulate programs by requiring school districts and charter schools that send students on study abroad trips to report annually to the Commissioner of MDE the following information: the number of deaths and hospitalizations that occur, the name, type, and locations where the incidents occurred. It directs the school to ask, but not require, enrolled students and their parents to report incidents. That's very important. Oftentimes, we don't even ask our kids and their families to tell us if anything has gone wrong. It requires MDE to aggregate and publish this data on their website, as well as link to the U.S. Department of State's information that reports on safety statistics abroad. And it allows the schools to supplement the incident numbers with a brief explanatory statement. It encourages the schools to adopt policies that outline standards to ensure health and safety of students. It requires that programs that provide a foreign exchange or study travel abroad experience annually register with our Secretary of State. These programs must also report the required safety statistics. It states that school districts, charter schools, the Department of Education are immune from civil and criminal liability when complying with Subdivision 2. It outlines national disclosure laws and state registry compliance, gives current and new disclosure regulations. Educational agencies or institutions must notify parents and students of their right to non-disclosure. Educational agencies or institutions may not disclose direct information to study abroad programs unless they are registered with the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State has actually put forward a cost of $1,000 to be able to take on this expanded role, which, again, is why I mentioned how generous they've been in their support of our adding this to their duties. I believe because the Secretary of State's role is spelled out in here that this bill would have to go to state and local government as well.
Yeah, actually, when we're ready for a motion, it'll go next to finance, and then it has a couple of stops.
Mr. Chair, isn't it in finance?
It's in a division E12.
Oh, gotcha. Right. Thank you. Okay, good. So my other testifier.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senator Bonoff. I'm Jabril Abdulazim. I'm a 22-year-old Muslim born and raised in this state in South Minneapolis. I'm the oldest of nine between my mother and father. This position and birth has made me a searchlight vessel for which channels are the best for advancement in life. I look left and I look right. Sometimes the views bear fogs and sometimes views are bright. I speak personally, but my sentiments are not confined to personal plight. Through my looking glass, I've seen red, white, and blue, and green, all the way to white and red, and even further to black, green, and yellow. Ever has this boy, from a mother of four children, single before her given gifts, developed a relationship more important than the one I forged with Tyler Hill. To enroll me in the people-to-people ambassador programs in the year 2007, my mother drained herself for months. Drained and exhausted herself to get me into something she thought would make me happy and make my life for the better. My mother could not have known from the promising letters and meeting get-togethers that she would inadvertently be exhausting herself for the better part of a year to send her oldest child into the hands of people that would disappoint me and leave me with my heart broken. As an inner city, disparate youth from disparaged communities, I was and am not still unfamiliar with letdowns from people in positions to make big promises. I've always had big dreams. One dream I held as a child was to learn the Japanese culture in great depth firsthand. So when receiving my letter of invitation from people to people with exclamations of becoming an international ambassador, developing important political relationships, living with a Japanese family, traveling across ancient grounds, and doing all this while earning high school credit, I could not help but ask my mother to aid me in raising thousands of dollars for what I thought was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to step on a grand stone that will propel me into a future I deserved. To prove I deserved it, my mother scraped together finances that she had never even held for herself. And I saw her as she sacrificed so much of herself because it was not easy for her to raise over $6,000. So now imagine my disappointment, as I expressed earlier, when my dream trip to Japan was not much more than a glorified tour bus vacation in the country. And those important relationships I was promised would never come to fruition. And then for the ones I did manage to build, to be strained by the untimely death of one of our own, my friend. I spent my trip coping with lackluster realities and walking on eggshells with inconsistent chaperones and left with enough grief to last my lifetime. It isn't fair to tell kids that they can make their lives better than take their money and not deliver, and ruin their spirits. My mother nor myself had known how unsafe I would be in the hands of people-to-people ambassador programs. And had we known, there was no way I would have been sent across the Pacific Ocean. I could not hear nor reach for my mother, even when I had my first extreme asthma attack while in Japan. Then it is so bold and dishonest to send letters to my home inviting my sisters into the program in 2008, inviting them into the program when people to people's record is as tainted and inexcusable as it is with my friend Tyler Hill's preventable death. All Minnesotans, all children should have the right to know what I know. Please pass Tyler Hill's Sunshine Bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I really appreciate your testifying today, and I'm very supportive of the bill. Just curious, Senator Bonoff, in our Northfield School District, the Rotary Club sends 20 people abroad. What kind of contact have you had with other groups that are like the Rotary that have done a lot of the exchange program over the years, and are they supportive of the bill, or are they affected by the bill?
Right.
Yes, thank you. I love the Rotary. I've been asked to speak to three. I'm invited to speak to the Minneapolis Rotary. As soon as this bill was introduced, we received our first donation from the Rotary, and they want to be the first role model. I'm meeting soon with some Rotary members. I have a major grantor who's willing to fund our future for, by some grace of God, we have some of the best tourism safety specialists in the world who secure safety of the Department of State and Department of Justice, who are helping us translate the broader tourism standards into student tourism. And we need a role model for that, and Rotary is inviting and embracing Clear Cause Foundation as the role model for safe global youth travel.
Thank you.
May I add something?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, for the trip, what I did for myself to help my mother to ease that burden of raising so much money for me, petitioned and was granted $1,000 for my trip with help from the Minnesota Rotary Club. So I just wanted that to be on the record.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What a story for both of you. And it is really amazing at how tragedy can be turned into good for others. And this is probably a great example of doing that. I totally support this. I mean, this is kind of something you'd almost think it wasn't being done before. So I'm really glad to see this coming forward. But I have a little special at stake. Our grandson is leaving next summer on a overseas trip, so while I was here, I quickly texted my son and said, check this out and look at this bill and do this. He happens to be in Wisconsin, by the way. We may be finding some support over in Wisconsin. If this is a model, maybe we'll go next door and help to get there. So just so grateful that you took your grief and turned it into something that will probably save other people's lives. Too bad it wasn't there for your own, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everything is prevented or bad things can't happen. We all know that. But this is just such an obvious thing. And so I'm just really thankful to both of you and to Senator Bonoff for something that can have a lot of good come from it. And I know even in the schools, when I think of some of the duties that gets put on them, but I think when we send our children somewhere and they're going under these umbrellas, it's so easy to assume how we do things here is how it's done everywhere. I've been to Guatemala on a medical surgical mission. Our son has as well. And so we've gone to other countries and we've seen their health care in some of these places, and the standards that we have here, there are a lot of good things that go on in these countries too, a lot of it, but in these unique situations that can sometimes cut between and not kind of have that. One of the, I don't see it in here, but there are insurance products that can go with travel abroad, so I haven't seen anything here in particular asking that question. Because I know just asking the question might make people think about it. Certainly something that I would want to think about. Maybe like Rotary has something already, but it's an issue that I think helps them to get back from overseas back home more quickly. So, Senator Bonoff, I'm just making that comment. Yeah. I don't know that we want to ask more, but just a thought.
Thank you. And Ms. Hill?
Yes, I would like to address
the
chairman and committee members. I take a lot of hard phone calls from families who are stranded when their kids are hurt or killed abroad and they have no resources to bring them home. I want you to understand the cost of that. Yeah. It can cost $50,000 to $70,000 to repatriate the remains of a child in a casket. It can cost $10,000 to $15,000 to repatriate their ashes. And it can cost $50,000 to $70,000 to repatriate them if they need medical evacuation. In some insurance programs, there is no insurance protocol for getting those kids out of the country if there is civil unrest, if there is a natural disaster, or if there is diseases like Ebola. So we do need that. And one of the surprising things for me as a parent is that before my son could play in a sport like rugby, he had to go to a doctor.
he had to get a physical release, and he had to show insurance, and he had to show power of attorney from a parent who was going to be there for them. None of that applies when students go abroad, but that would be a great Hail Mary and a great life-saving thing. So these students should all be going to travel clinics before they leave the country. They should all be adequately insured. And their parents really do need passports valued for more than 6 months beyond the end of their trip and powers of attorney to help them in that country. And I thank you for bringing this forward.
And, Mr. Chair, I just want to point to in the bill lines 3.7 through 3.9 does say that they must report on the terms and limits of the medical and accident insurance available. So,
okay.
Yep. So we wanted to make sure that this, the structure of the bill is not a new mandate, but rather shining a spotlight and giving parents and the districts information about what the programs do and do not, as well as the reporting of the incidents. And just one follow-up to Senator Dahl. When we did the bill for the post-secondary institutions, we actually brought all the colleges together and the University of Minnesota, and they together wrote that bill to make sure it would work for them. And so this this bill is fashioned after that.
Senators Claussen and Kent, and then I think we're ready to entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Bonoff, and testifiers for coming forward. And, you know, as a former high school principal, it was always on my mind when we'd send troops, because many times that's what it was, 100, 200 students abroad. And I would say at least 75% of the time I'd get the 3 a.m. call. Someone was hurt. Someone misbehaved. Something went wrong. And so it's really good that we're putting this in place to protect our students and our schools.
Yes.
And even though you took precautions in having the parents and students attend orientation sessions, you know, ahead of time and try to explain things, you know, when you have that many students going abroad, you know, the chances of something happening are quite high. And this is kind of a funny story about something going wrong, but I got a call about 1 a.m. from our band instructor in China. And they were being held up for a bribe at an airport before they'd allow their instruments to be placed on the plane. So they were literally bribed at the airport by one of the officials. They had to pay $500 in order to get the instruments placed on the plane. So you never know what's going to happen. Yeah. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I know from our work on higher education, and I was a co-author on that bill, that I'm glad because I know that process has gone through a learning process. Can you speak to any ways that this is being informed by that process, and will the Department of Education sort of have similar types of roles as the Office of Higher Education has had?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, yes, exactly. That's we looked at what worked with regard to that. We've actually, if you recall, we had to change some of the language to make sure the reporting was clear, and then I've been working with Representative Seltzer, who helped draft that, and she took that knowledge and met with the Department of Education and reviewed that process, and they're in communication. So we're definitely using that learning to shape this work.
Great. Thank you. And thank you all for being here to support this important legislation.
Thank you. Did anyone else in the audience wish to testify? If not, Senator Bonoff, motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1541 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Finance.
On that motion, further discussion? Not all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Adopted. Thank you, Senator Bonoff, Ms. Hill, and for all of you for your testimony. Thanks. My author's amendment can be
distributed. We have Senator Wieger's bill, Senate File 1498, and Senator Wieger, you have 5 minutes.
Senator Wieger, remember that.
Set the timer.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1498 has an author's amendment. I believe it's
A1 amendment.
I'd like to offer the author's amendment.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment to Senate File 1498, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment adopted.
Hey, and Madam Chair, members, Senate File 1498 basically relates to hiring bonuses for hard-to-fill positions and uses Q-comp funds. The author's amendment was done to provide needed clarification. I have a couple of testifiers that are here to talk about the need for the bill, and then we'll open for questions. And I'll ask Ms. Craigtharp from Educators for Excellence to lead off.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Holly Craigtharp. I'm a Minneapolis teacher, a Minnesota parent, and today I'm representing our 1,000 members from Educators for Excellence. And our members are in support of including this bill in the Senate Finance Omnibus Bill, because current law requires that the performance pay component of QComp can only be used to reward three things: personal goals, team goals, and school-wide goals. And we feel like this is a chance to support high-poverty schools with high staff turnover. We believe districts should have this flexibility in allotting QComp funds for teachers to work in hard-to-staff schools or hard-to-fill positions. And we believe that, research actually shows that we can lessen the burden on these hard-to-staff schools by taking action on several levels: the school level, the district level, and the state level. And currently we are working with schools and districts on options to support and incentivize teachers to go to hard-to-staff schools. And we're asking you members as support for the state action. We really believe that this is a chance to elevate the status of teaching in hard-to-staff schools, and there is no cost to this bill. I want to quickly end with a quote from one of our teachers, Caitlin Lindsay, who is an ELL teacher at Ann Sullivan Elementary School in Minneapolis. And in our report, she said that salary schemes reflect the values of an institution. Compensation focused on incentivizing whatever practice increases equity sends a message that teachers' professional objectives must be geared toward increasing achievement for all students. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Craigtel.
My name is Paul Winkler with Education Minnesota, and we're happy to support this bill on keeping using the tools available through contracts and through ATPPS to get teachers in places where they can be best be filled for the needs of the district. And I appreciate Senator Wieger's author's amendment to clarify some language on our behalf. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and also would like to thank Senator Wieger for the bill. Just quickly, as you've discussed many times this session, districts are having increasing difficulty finding teachers, especially in STEM, CTE, special ed. Senate File 1498 encourages districts to look at alternative compensation strategies as one way to recruit and retain these teachers. Similarly, districts may have trouble recruiting and keeping selected teachers at hard-to-staff schools. I'll cut short, but again, this creates an alternative strategy for districts to attract teachers to those schools as well as to retain them. Frequently, they can get teachers there initially, but over time they'll leave. This is one way to help create more stability at a school building. So with that, I will encourage you to support Senate Files 1498. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Senator Wieger, do you have any other?
Madam Chair, we have the Ed Minnesota Business Partnership and Educators for Excellence. This must be a great bill.
Are there any questions, or is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify in support of this bill or to add other comments? If not, Senator?
Would move that Senate File 1498 as amended be recommended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Yes.
Aye. Okay. And it passed.
That's it?
Yes, it passed, I believe.
Oh, yes.
Right. Okay.
The motion passed.
Yeah. And then members, for our next meeting tomorrow, the agenda, I believe, is on your agenda, and we'll also be meeting Thursday, I believe. Wednesday, we'll go into the evening if necessary. And then it's our intent at this point next week to have the omnibus draft shared with each caucus on Tuesday to be published Tuesday in the afternoon at some point, just as we did with the policy bill. And then on Wednesday of next week to have the rollout in committee with testimony. Again, the day before it would have been on the internet for the public to see. And then on Thursday we would mark it up, any amendments, et cetera, and then take action a week from Thursday. So that's the intent. And if anyone has, you know, questions or additional comments, please let me know, and then it'll be on its way to finance, taxes, eventually to the floor, et cetera. So.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, on Thursday, can the public comment? Will we have a public comment period as we review the omnibus bill?
A week from Thursday?
Yes.
Intent would be on a week from Thursday. It would be for member discussion and acting on amendments. If it was necessary to ask for an opinion on a particular amendment, we'll do that, but with restraint. We've been meeting for the past few months. We've had a great deal of testimony. There will be that additional opportunity for testimony next Wednesday on the bill. And most of these subjects have had quite a bit of airing already, but it would not be intended as another open mic, more focused on member amendments for a week from Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarify.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, the meeting is adjourned.
Okay. It's a nice job.